Donald, do you have a link to and to Etherpad?
Yeah, I'll paste that in the chat for everyone.
Okay, great. So then welcome everybody to the well, not the last session, but the last session of working groups of the fall interop. And this is a joint session of education, apps, DAL, and DM. Never thought I would be chairing an apps, DAL, or DM session. Now I have them all at once. That's really great. And I'm happy that we have now 50 participants already, that you all made it through until now. Very welcome to this. We're going to have two presentations, by the first one by Priya Hassan and the second one by Gregory Dubois-Felsmann. The first one will be related to the education interest group, and it is about the virtual education in COVID times. We had a EdOIG session in September about exactly this topic, which some of you attended and you may know about that. And Priya was there and also presented what she did in teaching, remote teaching. And she will present today about the virtual education COVID times. Priya?
Thank you, Henrik, and thank you, everyone, for giving me this opportunity to talk to all of you. And like Henrik mentioned, I had spoken about this in September, but that was a much smaller group. And hence, I'm today happy to be talking to a much larger group about what we've been doing in COVID times with virtual education. I think the theme, these have been very trying times for especially the teaching community, because for the first time, people were into the kind of virtual education that we've been doing now. A little bit of it was done in the past by us, but it was done very informally and, you know, not done very seriously. But since the past, you know, almost 8 months, especially like in India, we are actually doing virtual exams, classes, lab tests also on, you know, on Zoom platforms or various virtual platforms. And that's how this world has been a very big learning experience for the teaching community, especially in India. So I've actually written on the side what we've actually gone through. It was something like this, that, you know, I will teach you in a room. I'll teach you now on Zoom. I'll teach you in a house. I'll teach you with my mouse. I'll teach you here or there. I'll teach you because I care. So that's what basically the teaching community went through, especially, for example, in India, where we had to cope up with the times and continue with our teaching. Now, with this, the period just started. This is early April. You can see this is in May, June, because we already started some kinds of attempts by March and April, where we realized that the students were actually sitting at home. And it was essential to keep them occupied and do some things. So we'd had a short online astronomy course for students and kind of lab experiments, Joy of Learning, where the physics at home course, which we did, was typically just made up of doing physics experiments at home, literally with home stuff that we had at home. And then later on, the Office for Astronomy for Development actually came up with a call for COVID-related proposals. And we actually proposed something called Astronomy from Archival Data, where we basically thought that students, especially undergraduate, postgraduate, as well as research scholars, they could be actually trained by being shown step-by-step techniques of accessing, analyzing astronomy data from the internet into virtual astronomy tools, programming techniques, and supported to actually develop projects, right? So we started this project sometime, this was done in June, and we officially started up classes by August. So this was the project which was called Astronomy from Archive Data. And when we actually advertised it, to date we have 915 responses from 23 different countries, a lot of students, and thanks to, you know, the diversity in the countries, you can see, obviously not everybody attends it at the time we run the class, but But after class, it's all kept onto YouTube. And so a large number of students even access it through YouTube and later on get in touch with us about, you know, issues they have, etc. And we have a very good response from people from various countries, like I mentioned. So our team is me and I have my husband, Professor Hassan, and we've been working together with something called Srishti Astronomy, where we do outreach as well as education and all kinds of things. And in this period also, that's essentially what we were doing. So what we basically thought, virtual education has been there. We actually set up a nice website with and tried to make a presence. Contact is made with the students, also via Telegram, email, etc. And for all our sessions, we essentially had a lot of homework, quizzes, even feedback polls also from students, you know, so that they could be indicative to us as to how is the session going on and what do, you know, what do they feel about it, etc. A lot of variety of the speakers over there, some of them are present over here today. So we had Mark Taylor, who actually ran some TopCat session. We had Luisa Rubiribul, who did IPAC. And Bruno, Deborah actually sent me videos for ESA Sky, etc. Tim Hamilton actually led four different projects for students. Ajit Kimbhavi actually spoke about galaxy morphology. Avinash Deshpande is still talking about pulsars, etc. Kastub spoke about AstroPi and big data. So what we did is we basically tried to, other than us, we also gave our own talks. We tried to add up a large number of speakers who could actually enrich the whole program by adding in their this thing. And then our website has a lot of learning material. There are links to the studio, to the sessions, reading material, homework quizzes, etc., the software to be installed, things like that. What we also planned is that our classes all run on Saturday, Sunday mornings at 10 o'clock IST till 11:30. And essentially because students already gradually started on their classes, so it was good that our sessions were on Saturday, Sunday, disturb their schedule in case they were attending classes, etc. A lot of Spanish-speaking students also, so what was done on YouTube is we actually enabled subtitles so that even the Spanish-speaking or the other language-speaking students can use subtitles. And it was good that a lot of the research resource persons, like the ones whom I mentioned, many of them were happy to share their resources. The level has been slightly variable because, like I said, we have UGPG students, so there's a slight variation in the the level of the students. Some of the problems we faced is typically students having problems with network as well as with power, but we managed that because essentially all the classes are recorded and put onto YouTube. So whenever the student has access to the internet or power, network, etc., he or she can access all the material online. So we typically run it on Zoom. We have a licensed Zoom for 100 participants, and they can actually do their live interaction with the speaker while it's on. And the YouTube ones can also use the live chat to actually exchange whatever they would like to. So I started a YouTube channel the first time. We already have 461 subscribers and large number of views, etc. of these things. And like I said, all the material is available over here. And at present, we already have 56 videos from the time we've started. This is one of the ones using radio pulsars by Deshpande. This is still on. And other than that, we have a whole lot of these presentations. We also have some presentations by student groups. Like there's this other presentation you can see over here on stellar occultations. This is an amateur group which is doing serious observations of occultations. We also had another amateur who's actually using slew telescopes, robotic telescopes. And so he also described to participants as to how he's using that. This is a snippet of the website. So like I said, we start on the 1st of August and we plan to wind up the classes by the end of November. Students will then split up into different groups using different projects that have been proposed. And they'll present it by Jan 2021. They'll present their listings. So the tools we covered were basically Python, AstroPy, TopCat, Aladdin, ESA Sky, are some machine learning tools, Jupyter Notebooks, as well as Jupyter Notebooks on big data, etc. And the science cases, I was basically running most of the Gaia cases with ADQL, EsaSky, TopCat, as well as we ran some Jupyter Notebooks also, depending upon the students' level, either they could do it with TopCat or Notebooks. We did some projects with SDSS also, globular clusters. Kepler data was also used, analysis, exoplanet parameters, etc. There's another project being run with Magnetars, pulsar data, as well as galaxy morphology. Yeah, so that's my last slide. And the good news is that we have another OAD project which starts from January called Astro Sprint. And this would be a continuation of the work that we've done through these 6 months, where Astro Sprint basically comprises three workshops. The first one would be in March, so that would still be most probably virtual. But the other two workshops, which we plan in July as well as in October, these are planned to be face-on workshops where the participants who participated in this project as well as the next workshop can actually meet face-to-face and exchange their ideas. Yeah. So that's it. I'll just wind up with that. And like Henrik mentioned, I mentioned this to the group in September. And basically, I'm trying to use this opportunity to look for more contributions and participations from the community, because you know, VO has come of age where it can be really very well used for education. And the times, the present times we are living in, this is one of the best things to do for the teaching as well as for the student community. Yeah. So thanks. I'll end with that.
Thank you very much, Priya. Thank you very much. Does anybody have questions or comments to the presentation by Priya? Yes, Janet, please.
I just, I think you said it, Priya, but I would just like you to validate it again. What was the age group that you're targeting with these courses? And does it change when you get to 2021?
No. So basically, you said the level of the students, you mean?
The age group or the level of the students, where their education, okay. Where they are.
Yeah, so I would think the bulk, the youngest may be 18, 19, because that's when they generally start undergraduate. By that we mean, they are either in bachelor's or in master's. So I would say minimum 18. And then we have some people who are even faculty members. So they are, you know, much older.
Okay, that's interesting. Thank you.
Thanks.
More questions? I don't see anyone. I would be interested how long did you plan for each of the sessions? And you did some AstroPy and astronomy related tools like TopCat, Aladdin, EsaSky. Did you have hands-on sessions about these? And if so, how did you do that? I'd be very curious and interested in that, how that worked.
Yeah, so we did have hands-on sessions for that, because typically with students, what we've realized is that they attend theory classes, but there are hardly any hands-on sessions on the on the tools they use. It's generally assumed that the student will learn it by himself or by herself, just sit and do it. So what we make students do is sit with their laptops and we kind of do it together. And since people are logged in onto Zoom or by ask their questions in case something doesn't run. So that's how we try to do it. And then since they're on Telegram, they can continue, conversing. So in case they still have issues, they still ask us and we manage it like that.
Okay, thank you. Awesome. So, I think no more questions, which is good. So we can, we're going to proceed with the next presentation by Gregory Dubois-Felsmann about the discussion of protocols for handling file-oriented catalog data. Gregory, you're with us.
Yes, hi, I'm just sharing. There we go, hopefully this works. There we go. Okay, so I hope you're seeing the slides full screen. Okay,
yes.
So yeah, I'm Gregory Dubois-Felsman. I'm the science platform scientist from the Rubin Observatory. And I'm the product owner for the Rubin Science Platform, which is the mechanism through which we will make the data from the LSST survey available to the community. I'm also a staff scientist at IPAC and the pipeline system designer for the SphereX mission, which is going to produce an all-sky spectral catalog during the mid-2020s. I have shared interests from both of these projects that I'll express here. I'm speaking from common concerns and interests both of the Rubin Observatory and of IPAC. URSA in particular, but I think these issues are broadly applicable, and this is a conversation starter. I'm trying to stimulate some interest in the IVOA in moving our standards to another level to handle the challenges of this decade. So as I say here on the slide, bulk processing of wide area catalog data is becoming increasingly important, even as the catalogs themselves are growing. So catalogs of billions to tens of billions of objects are becoming the baseline for the community. Gaia has 1.5-ish billion objects. ZTF is a comparable. The LSST survey will have tens of billions of objects. This is the norm. SphereX will have billions of spectra. So these data sets are used for machine learning. People will want to compute derived characteristics like photometric redshifts for an entire catalog. They'll want to do match template searches of time series data or spectral data. So for instance, we'll have our several billion spectra from SphereX. Then people will be trying to look for perhaps rare spectral types by searching through that entire corpus. And people want to do cross-matching of multiple catalogs and joint analyses of data sets from many surveys and missions. So in the community, people are using contemporary data science tooling to do this kind of work. We live in a very exciting era in which the world outside our field is contributing a tremendous amount of infrastructure that's useful for us. These systems generally are for processing such large data sets are shared nothing, and they often use file-oriented approaches to organizing the data. I'm talking about parallel processing systems like Spark and Dask. Many of you probably are familiar with these. If not, ask around the people around you and you'll surely find someone who's been working with this. These systems often try to optimize their I/O by using column-oriented data formats. And a very common one that's being used these days is Apache Parquet, so common that one fairly often hears that this is becoming the new CSV. It's viewed by many of the archives as a peer to providing data in more traditional database query systems. So we're not giving up on the relational databases, but we recognize that certain analysis cases are just much better served by a shared nothing infrastructure. So the data are often spatially sharded into files in order to support the parallelism, and that'll be key in what I say later. There's a rich ecosystem of analysis packages that can be used once the environment is in place, because we're using community standard, things that are standard in a community broader than just astronomy. Many projects are planning to build server-side analysis environments. We often call these science platforms in order to support these analysis models. The resources available in those platforms are always going to be limited, so people will want to bring the data to their own systems in many cases. And again, as I said before, joint analysis of data from multiple projects is often key to the science we want to do in the 2020s. So in that regard, interoperability would help to facilitate this kind of data exchange and lower the barriers to doing those kinds of joint analyses. So bulk download, which is has been a thing since forever in our archives, is becoming more user facing at this point, and it's exposed to more people. So we've always provided means for bulk download of catalog data. So you can click on the link here and see how this is done at IRSA for many of the surveys that we host. Typically, there have been a relatively small number of wide area surveys with data sets that were large enough that they couldn't be exported as a single file. So, WISE is an excellent example. There, depending on the particular piece of the WISE data that you're looking at, we're talking about hundreds of files involved, and large files, each of which is a moderately heavy lift to download across a modest size pipe. This is often done in a slightly different way for each project. The formats for constructing the files themselves are different. The way that the schemas of the files are documented for the users who are going to take advantage of these bulk downloads is different. And that reflects the fact that often these systems were used either by other data centers who wish to mirror the data sets or by highly motivated individuals who had an overriding scientific need to kind of dig into these details. So if it's another data center, if the Gaia data set is being exported from ESA and we want to import it at IPAC, clearly the value of that data set to our community is very high, and we're motivated to go and like study the instructions and figure out what to do and how to import that data into our systems. Another key point is that these data sets were rarely used in place. Typically, you'd FTP them or something over to your site and then work on them there. But this is changing. So we have more users now who are going to want to do this. We have more users of multiple data sets simultaneously who want to limit the friction involved with learning the structures used for each mission's separate data set. And we're moving towards an era where the data sets will be held in the cloud and therefore be suitable for in-place access. All right, kind of wrapping up the motivation here. So the picture is shifting from one in which we sort of drop a big pile of CSV files in a directory on an FTP server with some documentation, to one in which we have end users who are interacting directly with the files, where the files need to be in a format that's amenable to efficient analysis, and they want to do this with standardized data science tooling. The Rubin Observatory, so this is not hypothetical, right? The Rubin Observatory plans to make its major catalogs available through a TAP service, certainly, but also as sets of Parquet files available for analysis in our science platform, but also for external download. IRSA is developing both hosted and externally available environments for bulk analysis of its catalog holdings, including a new initiative in hosting large simulated data sets. And the timescales of the work in most of these institutions are immediate. We are doing this work now, and it would be very helpful to get guidance from the IVOA community or also to perhaps be a source of some energy in driving standards that support this kind of work. So I want to pose sort of five challenges for us to pursue. So all the things I've talked about above give me and my colleagues a sense that improving interoperability for file-oriented catalog holdings would be a really valuable area for standardization. And these are the areas that I think we should discuss over the course of maybe the next 6 months and hope to maybe have a progress report at the next interop. So the discovery of the existence of large file-oriented catalog data sets is of interest, so that people who are trying to do joint analyses can actually know what's available out there, and particularly if they would be amenable to analysis through cloud access. Metadata service for the content and the spatiotemporal coverage of the individual files within such data sets. I'll say more about that in a few minutes. Query capabilities within those metadata services to allow users to identify a subset of files if they don't want to do an all-sky analysis. means for applying our 15, 20 years of work in documenting the schemas of tabular data sets with VOTable and providing annotations with DataLink for things like service descriptors that allow people to do more with the data in rows in the catalog, while also enabling the use of Parquet and other comparable future formats. And then finally, keeping these standards open to language level bindings so that we maybe don't go down the same route that we have for the last 10 years, where the standards were developed quite independently of what was going on in the Python ecosystem. And now we're having to kind of put quite a bit of effort into gluing things back together by investing in PyVO and trying to make it easier for people to use the standards from the familiar community languages. So this is an effort that cuts across apps and DAL and DM at least. This might, if people are interested, become a major cross-cutting theme for our work for a while. All right, so I'm gonna go through these things one at a time, and this is just meant to now to stimulate discussion. I don't have very much to say, but I really actually want to kind of ask those who are on the line for their comments on suitable solutions and maybe places where there aren't solutions and where we need to do some work. And we can take notes on the Etherpad and then use that to guide an allocation of effort in the months to come. So right now, it's not entirely clear to me whether we have a satisfactory way right now to just announce to the world that we have such a data set available for download. When that's, let's say a spatially sharded data set of tens of billions of rows over tens of thousands of files or something like that. So any comments or discussion on this point?
So I was just going to write into the Etherpad. So of course, this depends a bit on how many of these are expected to exist and what the actual discovery models are going to be. But assuming that this is about the same granularity as our normal discovery is, give me catalogs that have this and this property, and I'd assume that most of those will already have a tab capability or a cone search. And if that is true, then I'm pretty sure that these file-oriented holdings should be just another capability. So essentially, we define a capability, and I'd be happy to help out designing the registry extension. And that would be it. Things become a bit more difficult when you expect that when you expect to have millions of such file-oriented catalog holdings. If that were true, then I'd look at something more like, I don't know, these OpsCore catalog things that ESO is already pushing out.
But I'm getting to OpsCore for documenting the what's in each of the files in such a data set. But for the whole data set, I think what you say makes sense. And I think the assumption that the number of such data sets is relatively modest is a good one, at least for the way I see it at the moment. Thank you, Marcus. All right, so I'm going to go on to the next slide or the next two slides, there and maybe we can come.
Is that another?
Oh, sorry, Gregory, there. What oh, great. You oh, with the question?
Excellent. Yes.
Are you still assuming still a kind of standardized data format like Parquet? Or would you also allow any kind of custom proprietary data formats?
I think the spirit would be to encourage well-known data formats that are accessible to community tooling. I mean, I wouldn't want to like make a fetish of Parquet specifically, the spirit of interoperability certainly is that if we're just talking about proprietary Oracle dump files, that's probably not the spirit of things here.
So yesterday in our session on theory, we talked also about, say, simulation files, where generally the files themselves indeed make some sense, but they are in a proprietary format, but indeed they have a part of a simulation box. Mm-hmm. But recently, I mean, we're working a lot at the moment with Parquet files inside of Spark HDFS, mm-hmm. where it's up to the system to distribute it, and we have not necessarily real knowledge about what the contents of each file is. Mm-hmm. So you would still expect that each unit is well describable. It might not always be the case.
Okay.
So it puts a demand then on the data provider to actually start reformatting the data in a form that could be done here, as opposed to allowing, say, Spark SQL queries to be sent to the backend. And that might be a...
Well, I think if a data publisher is in the situation that you just described and they're willing to offer a Spark SQL service, then I think the community would be ecstatically happy if there were a nice TAP server to layer on top of Spark SQL. And I gather our colleagues at UW are already working on that.
We did just download a couple of terabytes of their data in the Parquet file. And so people do bulk downloads.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and sometimes you just want all the data, and what I'm going to be talking about is less important. But we're also looking at an era where, let's say, on the NASA side, one option NASA is considering is to host a large number of its data sets all in the cloud. And provide a sort of an astronomy-wide kind of science platform environment that's not limited to one of the brand, let's say, of one of the existing archives. And if you had a number of such data sets in a cloud-based system, it would seem like an interoperable way to document all of those holdings. It would be quite valuable. And would facilitate creating, also the Python level APIs for finding those data sets and naming them, when you're trying to actually run your Spark job, to have a uniform way to refer to those data sets would be quite helpful, and a metadata standard would be useful there. So let me maybe continue to the next slide, because it's really germane, unless there's another question.
Nope, please continue.
Okay. Sorry, I didn't have the display up to let me see the little blue hands. So I'll
wait. That's my job.
So, yeah, I'll wait for your cue there. Okay, so, all right, so a metadata service. So we already have a model for having a collection of files that represent observation, even relatively abstracted ones like catalogs, in OBSCore. And there's a lot that's good in OBSCore and that's relevant here for defining the instrument and the facility that were used, the wavelength regime, the time ranges, and so on. But I think there's a problem with the spatial coverage model. So I have here on the slide just an example of our colleagues at the Dirac Institute at UW, who have devised this system they call AXS for doing astronomical cross matches in Apache Spark. And this is just a cartoon of the sharding, but the idea is the sky is divided into narrow bands that they call zones, and a typical number here is like 10,000. This is, as I said, this is just a cartoon to have only 16 of them, and then the zones are allocated to what they call buckets, which are materialized as Parquet files, and many zones go into a bucket. And in the interests of spreading the storage relative and the IO load relatively uniformly across galactic and extragalactic regions and kind of averaging across other fluctuations in the coverage, where you may have some surveys may not even cover the whole sky, they're allocated to buckets with some form of hash. Now in the publication from which I took this, the the hash was a simple mod function. That's not always the case. But in any case, what you get is highly non-compact spatial coverage of each particular bucket. So if you were going to try to document the files in an obscure service, you would be at a loss for how to do this with STCS in a way that any reasonable service could interpret. I mean, in strictly speaking, you could write a long union, but I would suggest that that's not really compatible with any realistic OBSTAP or SIA type services that that we have in the community to be able to handle unions across thousands of non-disjoint stripes like that. So we really don't have a good way to represent non-compact spatial sharding. And I think this is the next thing I wanted to discuss. I think I have a few more words on the next. Yeah. So some of these data sets will be sharded in kind of conventional overlapping tiles, as maybe associated with tangent planes. So an example of that might be the you know, the way that that the atlas images were generated from past surveys. And then if you imagined binning up the catalog data by co-added atlas image, you might get a data set like that. Sometimes the data will be organized by heel picks or HTM indices on the sky or other kinds of all sky binnings. And some, like the AXS sharding, will be highly non-compact. So I'd like to ask whether we could consider mock for a general solution enabling query. Of course, you know, mock is defined to be conservative. It's an upper bound on the coverage. But I think it's something that we should really look at to see if there's a way that we can add as some kind of extension to OBSCORE, a way to represent coverage as a mock rather than in this sort of quasi STCS mechanism. So I think this is a point where I want to stop and invite people to just contribute their own perspectives on this rather than listen to me continue to natter on.
I think so I can only say yes, you want to use mock, in particular with the PTSphere extension that I was talking about.
I was very excited to see that.
Right, I think that's a natural match. I mean, I don't promise that it's going to solve everything, but it sounds like a pretty good match.
And of course, we could consider STMock. You know, if the temporal coverage needs that level of fine grainedness. I mean, it's not clear. You know, that might be very useful in some cases and in others less so. I mean, sometimes this, you know, like for LSST, we'll, you know, for our co-added catalogs, it's a 10-year survey and we can give you a T start and a T end in OBSCORE and that will be fine. But there are other kinds of catalogs for which fine grained time coverage might be very, very important. Surely there might be other comments here. I was hoping this would be the most provocative point.
Yeah. I don't see more comments, but I also support, well, the idea behind it at least. So, and yeah, oh, there's Ada. Yes, please.
No, I just want to say that that I totally support the idea of having this query by mock option. Yeah, and as you were saying, for the extension of the temporal coverage, I think it has a very interesting use case for the multi-messenger context. And I wouldn't rule it out for LSST, just saying a min and a max of the times would probably cut it. I think it would a finer or a better refinement on the temporal coverage could enable amazing use cases.
I mean, certainly we have time-dependent catalog data for which our DIA object and our source catalogs are time-dependent, and there STMock is a much more compelling case because there's, you know, every place on the sky is going to end up with a different seasonal cadence because it's a ground-based survey
Exactly. Exactly. That's the point there. Yeah.
So in concrete terms, I'm not trying to write into the Etherpad right now myself, but I'll come back afterwards and I can annotate it. But I'd like to sort of commission, as it were, like a concrete effort to see like what would it mean to put mock into OBSCore. I think that's a very clear action item that should be explored at this point. Okay. Henrik, shall I continue?
I don't see any more raised hands, so please continue. Yes.
Okay. All right. So actual query capabilities is the next point. If we now imagine that we have metadata services for collections of spatially sharded bulk catalogs of this nature, we would like to allow users to identify the subset of files which cover a region of interest to them. Let's say you're only interested in the LMC for some reason, and you'd like to download perhaps only 4 files instead of 4,000 files, we would like to make it possible for you to find out which ones they are. I think between what Marcos just mentioned now and what he presented earlier in the week about enabling PGSphere to query against mocks carried as attributes in a database, I think we are starting to get something like a picture of what this could look like. But I think this would be nice to have an SIA V2, but for these types of files. And let's be clear, I'm not conflating that with cone search, right? If you want to directly query for the actual catalog entries within your search region, you can still do that via cone search. I think there's a project underway to continue work on cone search. It would be interesting to see where that goes for large queries. But in this case, as an SIA style query, what you're getting back is not actually, 10 million rows. It's links to a small number of files in which those 10 million rows and presumably some neighbors within their tiles would be found. And then you could run a cloud job that directly accesses those files in situ, or you could download them to your own system as you choose. That's the picture I have in mind here. So again, comments?
Marco, please.
Yeah, I wonder if this goes in the direction that we are already speaking since some time of changing the I in SIAB to something that is more image cubes or something like that. One thing that happened to me to think about now is how much will the response change in that case, considering what you're saying, and given that I really understood what you mean.
I would expect an extended OBSCore response from such a query to come back with 1 row per file. The access URL might be, and let's say an Amazon S3 flavored one. It might not be a straightforward one, and the MIME type for it might be a MIME type, which I think we still need to invent for Parquet. I'm sure someone's already put an X in front of Parquet and put that out on the net somewhere, but it would be nice to have an agreed upon value for that or for any other comparable format.
Mm-hmm. So I see this simply as another step towards some sort of data set discovery, yeah, as Francois described once. But Francois, yep, is hand raised, so I suppose you will see indeed better Francois than me.
Yeah. Yeah, and we have a, I think already, you know, there's this kind of catch-all measurements value of data product type that could be pressed into service here, but we, you know, we could think a little bit more about what appropriate values for data product type are in a situation like this.
I think Tom raised his hand before Francois, if I interpret the order right.
Okay, well, we'll see if my question is worth it. Thinking about these queries and the mention of mock a few times already, I'm wondering how well understood these query use cases are. I'm wondering, you know, how often will it be spatial coverage that is the primary constraint in your search, or will it be, you know, so many of these machine learning things, are they just going to be picking things at random? Are they going to be picking things in certain energy ranges?
All of the above, I think. I mean, look, in some cases, if we go back to my first question about discovery, if I know I want to do a big bulk machine learning analysis, all I need to do here is maybe I go and say, hey, where is the LSST object catalog available as bulk data on the cloud?
Mm-hmm. Right?
And so I might go to such a service with query parameters saying, you know, is it available in Parquet format, right? Format equals Parquet in an SIA style, SIA V2 style query. And I might not have any spatial constraint at all, in fact. I might be asking explicitly for LSST, or I might be asking for everything in the, you know, the optical and the near IR. Those are, you know, I think we can start to imagine being able to do some very powerful things if we envision a state that we might get to in a couple of years where we could have, you know, all of the well-known all-sky catalogs on a single service that people could query in a you know, sharded, in a bulk sharded way. I'm sure my UW colleagues would love to have all of their AXS sharded versions of these familiar catalogs, you know, PanStars and something from DES and ZTF and so on, all available through a common interface like that.
Yeah, no doubt.
I don't know if we actually have someone who can directly represent Dirac on the line here. Anyway, that was the theory, but I wanted to not just limit this to parochially to the people who are the bulked up users of the entire data set, right? I wanted to also enable people who might really only need a spatial subset in certain cases.
Yeah, that makes sense.
We would have one more question from Francois Bonnarel, I think.
No, it was just a comment that if you look at the issues in SIA and also SODA, which may be also something interesting for you, the issue already exists to add a mock query style in SIA interface, as well as in SCS. And it's also interesting for SODA.
Yeah, so
I don't know if you will have a slide about SODA-like things later.
No, I hadn't gotten that far, but I would welcome exploring that avenue. So I just want to make sure when we take notes on what needs to be done, there's both having a mock-oriented query capability where the query parameters take a mock, or maybe they use DALI upload to let someone upload a FITS mock as to be used in the query or something like that. And having the coverage itself documented on the back end as a mock in the OBSCore model, right? That's another point, so that we can have so that when you get a query result back, you get a mock for each file, not just be able to query by mock. So of course that makes the server do the intersection of the query mock and the mocks in the files that it holds.
So there is another question from Marcus.
Okay.
So the one thing I wonder is it actually worth digging so deep there? I give you that it's possible that you have thousands of files, but how frequent is that? And if it's less than, I don't know, 1,000 or so, I believe you can work wonders by just having a convention for file names. And then you basically what you discover is just a link to basically a directory, whether exposed by FTP or HTTP or S3 or whatever. And within that directory are simply file names with a certain structure. I mean, I'm not saying this is the end all. I'm just saying it would be a very simple way to do things.
I'm a little bit reluctant. I understand the value there, right? But AXS is doing it one way, and but even there, I think the convention is not the essential element there at the moment. This zoning convention. I'm a little bit nervous there because the file names would be hard pressed to encode all the spatial coverage unless the hashing algorithm were also included as part of the query, and that starts to get to be very AXS specific. Whereas I think we want to support a wider variety of spatial shardings. One of them certainly being AXS because it looks like a nice system. But I'd be happy to think about that more, Marcus.
It seems you poked in the right hive. There are a lot more, even more hands raised. So Jesus.
Oh, very good. Okay, that's the.
As you said, that in Gaia, apart from the archive itself, we have a dump in files so that people can download the files. And what we have is in the name of the file, as Marcus is telling, the minimum and the maximum Hilbert index of the source. But I agree that this is only as a quick and dirty approach to help the users to identify the sources inside this file. So if you have something more powerful, mock or whatever, I think it's a good idea to investigate that. So we didn't think too much. Basically, we create this in order by Hilbert index, and we create that with a set a number of sources per file. With the in the name, we put the minimum and the maximum. But yeah, maybe something more complex can be done. Yeah.
Okay, and there is another hand raised by Steve Room. Please, Steve.
Yeah, hi. So I was just going to make a similar comment about encoding representation in the file names like that. It's certainly something that we do now is make use of that, but just a general picture from the data provider's perspective, I think is we're looking to a longer future where we no longer use the file system as a means of encoding metadata. In an object future, we have to make the object IDs, you know, more neutral, and we need another system to encode that metadata anyway. So while it's certainly an effective solution as a practical one for the near term, I'd like to support this proposal that we look beyond that as a way of registering content and encoding that representation somehow other than the file name.
So it seems no more hands raised. So I think you can continue. I think you're just raising the right questions right now, because there are a lot of comments in the chat, in the Etherpad, and I'm trying to track them all. but please
so,
continue.
Yeah, I'm almost done here with the slides. So I'm gonna try to get to what I think is the most critical remaining one here. I see the hour is almost over, and then I'll try to take a look at the live chat and see if I can pick out something that seems salient. I've not been trying to follow the live chat so that I can keep all of my attention focused on what people are saying, what I'm saying. Okay, schema definition.
Just jump in and let people know. Sorry, I'm just jumping in to let people know that for record keeping, I'm copying all the chat into the Etherpad for posterity, but feel free to follow conversations in either place.
All right, thank you. Okay, so schema definition. So we've put, it's I guess it's sort of fair to say kind of two decades of work into a really valuable infrastructure for documenting the schemas of columnar data. And, you know, we're still developing it little by little. We're focusing on things like coordinate systems for space and time and the like. This is all a great acquired body of work. Now the community is off doing something else. And when the community puts the data into Parquet format, they're not using all of this. And so I fear that we're going back to the world of CSV files with an accompanying text file that explains what the columns are, unless we kind of catch the wave here and find a way to keep our ability to represent columnar data schemas, but also enable these file formats. So in that context, there is one very obvious thing to do that's an extension of an existing pattern, which is to allow the use of Parquet as a VO table data payload type. So this makes use of the capability in VO table to have the data table is effectively externalized. I mean, it could even be base 64'd, but I don't really feel like base 64ing a 20 gigabyte Parquet file. So that's one possibility. So that would work almost today, as long as people learn to expect this convention to be followed. But I'm a little nervous about something, which is that there are going to be a lot of users who are just going to want the files and who are going to be doing things that don't depend on the metadata, or at least they don't critically depend on the metadata. And we know from the history of people doing this kind of work that there's a lot of tolerance in the community for pain if the data set is sufficiently valuable. This has always been a place where the IVOA has been a little bit on the back foot, because the interoperability was not that interesting to people who were willing to accept that pain for a uniquely valuable data set. And it was more valuable for the casual user, but the casual user wasn't as strong a constituency in a way. So a model in which there's sort of a little sugar sprinkled on top of the Parquet files that some people will eat and some people won't worries me, because I worry that people will download all the Parquet files and not their VO table wrappers, for instance, and then we'll have data sets sitting around that are not actually, that don't have their schemas documented. I'd like to at least think about whether we have a way to inject a VO table compatible schema, possibly the actual XML itself, or possibly some other representation. I don't feel like being prescriptive about that, into a Parquet file as, let's say, an extra table, even if it's just a one row table with a single text blob column, or, you know, whatever it takes to do it, as long as there's a well-defined naming convention, maybe something worth exploring. I don't feel like I'm in any position to make a recommendation here, but this seems like something we should think about. So again, open floor.
Yes, please, Mark.
I don't know enough about Parquet, about the Parquet format, to know whether this makes any sense. But something like what you're suggesting is essentially what I've been doing with FITS files for a long time. I've taken the VO table, the metadata content of the VO table, and just stuck it in the primary HDU of VITS files. And if you're not looking for it, you don't notice it. But if TopCat finds it, it uses that as the metadata additional to the metadata that's in VITS files. And that's worked pretty smoothly for a long time. As I say, I don't know whether that trick will work with Parquet, but the general idea works quite well.
It looks likely to me that it would work, but I haven't, the next step would be to prototype it.
So with Parquet, is there any kind of, is there like a central node attached to a bunch of Parquet files, or is every Parquet file just one thing and you have no idea what siblings it's got? It comes with some others or it doesn't, it's just like that.
I think in the context of something like Spark, you can have the effective equivalent of a central node, because obviously all the files have to have a compatible schema in order to make it make sense to have a sharded parallel analysis like that. But we're also trying to make the files usable independently of each other here.
I guess I could add to that. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think in the Parquet on Spark case, there's no real central knowledge of the data, but when Spark reads it in, and normally it does this in the Hive, using this Hive format for partitioning, it will read in the metadata that's at the end of each of the Parquet files to make sure the metadata match. And I think also in the case that you're talking about here, you can include data at the end of the Parquet file in that metadata area to maybe link it to some VO table data.
I mean, as a sort of a quick and dirty solution to this, which might actually be one that has a high likelihood of getting standardized, could we imagine just taking a few kilobytes of XML and sticking them into one field in that Parquet file metadata?
Yeah, I mean, that would be one way to do it. There are standard fields that exist in that metadata, but you're welcome to add your own with some prefixing. I can't remember exactly. I've done this before for other purposes, but I can't remember exactly how it's structured, but it does have the flexibility for that. So, I mean, yeah, technically you can do what you just described. Okay. Or individual fields as well.
So, I mean, it is also possible that if the metadata model, which I'm not that familiar with in Parquet, is sufficiently rich, that we could find a way to in an information preserving way, fully project the VO table data model into it. I just don't know. My intuition leads me to skepticism, but it's uninformed intuition. I kind of would like to have at least the option of just dumping it in as is, because we know we have a lot of code bases that can deal with such a thing. And it's compatible with the spirit of the organization of VO table to really have the schema quite separate from the data.
I'm a bit reluctant to end the session right now because we are 5 minutes over time, and at least for Donald, who's taking the notes that for Tom, I'm making this, I'm sorry, I'm such a zombie already. Tom, who's taking the notes already, might be a bit exhausted here. So I see David Rodriguez still has his hand raised, and I think there, I take from the chat that this is you raised rather interesting questions and topics here, and I don't even know how to assign this to, because it's AppStyle and DM. I know the chairs are all here, so I hope everybody is taking notes from the notes from the Etherpad and takes that home, and the discussion will follow. If that's okay, I would end the official bit here, and we have 25 minutes for the closing sessions. But I think we can still be around, and we can still unofficially discuss this more openly, or keep that discussion open, if that is okay. Maybe it might be good if we just keep the recording the session. Is that okay with you, Pat? Would that be a solution?
Yeah, I'll keep recording.
Yeah, it's fine with me. I mean, I can't stay all the way through the half hour, but it would be nice to, I think I have one slide left, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I just think this is an interesting discussion, and we just end the open the official session here, and you can just, well, yeah, continue. I will stay and keep track of raising hands. That's fine, but I think people should not feel obliged to stay.
I really appreciate anyone who does, but I'm absolutely, you know, we've all been through a bunch of things at weird hours in various time zones and are a little bleary-eyed. So
I'll just make a quick request, because I maybe was a little Zoom beat as well. So anyone who wants to go through and improve the poor notes that I took, any passes through that would be most welcome. Thanks.
So there was a question by, forgot the name. I'm sorry. I remember that, Rodriguez.
Yeah, that was me. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, so it was just a comment, I guess, since some of the discussion, a lot of it has been very heavy on Parquet, and well, I'm not familiar with it, but I worry that we may be tying too much of like how we're storing the metadata into this very specific file format that could change. One thing that I think you mentioned, Gregory, that I just want to highlight as a potential thing is storing a table that contains the schema definition, right? So something like the tab schema information. So it was just that sort of brief comment that saying, I think that is a more generalized approach that can perhaps be more future proof than relying on whatever Parquet has.
Well, that's also why I was kind of attracted to the idea of an opaque dump of the XML into the file, because I feel like almost any modern file format would let us do that. So in one way or another, we just need a naming convention for where to find the dump in the file. But I think this is the kind of thing that can be explored at a working group level, and with the aim of producing a resolution soon. I mean, I want to repeat, all of the projects I either directly represent or am sort of semi-empowered by have a relatively short fuse for wanting to come up with some solutions in this area. So we're really motivated to help the community narrow down some possibilities here.
I think Mark Taylor raised his hand.
I was going to ask a question which is slightly related to the previous one, which is, do you think it's going to be Parquet rather than something that's a bit like Parquet? I mean, for instance, I was going to put some effort into supporting a sharded file format. Is that what I should look at?
Well, concretely, the Rubin Observatory has decided to use Parquet for the time being. I mean, that's our initial beginning of the survey baseline. We're very aware that these things change quickly in the data science community, and there might be something much more compelling that emerges. So I do agree. I think there was something the previous speaker said. I don't want to invest a great deal of time in Parquet-specific infrastructure at IBOA level, but rather to find a way to embrace and extend here, and is more what I think is the right approach.
I agree with that.
One thing as a tool developer, Mark, we're thinking about the same things for Firefly, obviously. Because it's a columnar data store, accessing it with a tool is not quite the same thing as reading in a CSV file. You don't have to read the whole file in. You can think of it more like a query, right? You know, somebody gives you a Parquet file, you read in the metadata for the Parquet file, you put up a query interface, as it were, then says, you know, you can use the optimized I/O to say, I want to only load the rows from this file where the I-band magnitude is, greater than 17 or something like that, right? And then so then that scan is rapid because it only loads that one column. And then when you find something that you like, you go across and you load the rest of it. That's something that I would hope we could do in Firefly. We haven't laid out a concrete plan for that yet. I see Trey just unmasked himself.
I would imagine our table tool acting similar to the way it does now, except it's hitting a Parquet file instead of a database in the back end.
Yeah. So it would look a little bit like a database query,
yes,
rather than just blindly loading everything that's in the file.
Yeah, I mean, I try to avoid doing that anyway, which is why I don't particularly like CSV files. But I mean, you know, with FITS, I don't blindly load everything. I go and get bits of the file that I need.
Yeah. Okay, I think in the interest of time, I should move to what I believe, if I remember correctly, is my last slide. I don't really have very much concretely to say here. I just, I want to be cognizant of making sure that whatever we do is readily usable in the end user community from the query and data analysis environments that they're actually using, whether that's Python or R or something. Julia, it doesn't really matter, but I want to try to avoid inventing something that requires then someone to write a kind of a heavyweight library on top of it. And that's another reason why, if we could leverage existing VO table header parsing code, that might get us on the air faster. Perhaps given the time, this is something we should more discuss in working group meetings. But this is important to me as a kind of guiding principle.
I don't see any more raised hands, so thank you very much, Gregory, for this interesting presentation. And I really don't know how to proceed from that. I hope people will take the advice, and we will see the protocol from the session, I think, and somehow proceed with this. I'm lucky here because I'm education, so it's actually not.
I might ask the TCG to give us some guidance here for how to proceed with dispatch to make some progress. It looked like Pat was tempted to unmask there for a moment.
I was just going to check if I think I'll stop recording here.
Okay.
Yeah, and, thank you.
It was a great session.